Exodus 23, verses 10 to 33 is our passage this morning. In the service royal, let us not grow cold. Serving the Lord, the living God, is a sustained and ongoing and long-term business. It's not like doing an exam. When you do an exam where you're at 1 week before the exam, or indeed where you're at 1 hour after the exam, is irrelevant. Everything depends on your performance during that short window when the thing itself is taking place. Serving God is not like that. It's not about being free of idols and dedicated to God during certain windows of heightened importance, and outside of those windows, it doesn't really matter. No, it's about living for Him day in, day out. That marvelous phrase coined by the atheist Friedrich Nietzsche, but given a Christian meaning by Eugene Peterson in the title of one of his books. It's about a long obedience in the same direction. A long obedience in the same direction, or in a single word, it's about faithfulness. That's what God wants from His people. God wants faithfulness. It's what He wanted from these Israelites, and it's really what this passage then that we're looking at this morning is about. God is directing His people here to the kind of faithful living that He wanted them to practice throughout the years to come. And in that connection then, two things in particular are highlighted, which we're going to spend a few minutes looking at together. And first of all, faithfulness is demanding. So this faithfulness that we're talking about, this long obedience in the same direction, this keeping going day in, day out, living for God, it's demanding. And this is verses 10 to 19. So you fork out lots of money and buy an idyllic property right beside a lovely beach somewhere. And as you do so then, and as you move into your house with its magnificent sea views and all the rest of it, you feel like you're living the dream. However, it doesn't take very long for you to realize that there is another side to this new life of yours. Maintaining that house beside the beach is extremely demanding. The reason for that is its inhospitable environment. Such a coastal location as that is not really conducive to living in. There are raging winds that come unobstructed from the sea and buffet that house. There's the sand picked up by the wind and hurled ferociously at your property's walls. At very high tides, there's the possibility of flood damage. There's all that salt constantly in the air, liable to corrode certain types of material. And faced then with these unrelenting threats to your property, you have to be on top of things all the time, keeping the roof in good order, keeping the cladding of the walls in good order, keeping the flood defences around the house in good order, constantly making sure that the place is in a fit state to handle the next storm that comes along. And maintaining one's faithfulness to God is a bit like maintaining that house. It too is demanding, and it's demanding for the same reason, an inhospitable environment. Paul talks, doesn't he, in Galatians 1 verse 4, about this present evil age. That's where the Israelites lived, and that is where you and I live, this present evil age. It's an age where Satan and his demons are strenuously active. It's an age where the idolatrous culture all around us is highly seductive. It's an age where our regenerated hearts and lives still have the flesh as a residual presence within them. In short, it's not a context that's conducive to pursuing faithful, God-honoring lives. And so, as I say, maintaining one's faithfulness to God, a bit like maintaining that beachside property, is demanding. And recognizing that then, verses 10 to 19 here feature two emphases. First of all, an emphasis on Israel's calendar. You notice that in these verses. An emphasis on Israel's calendar. God here, as it were, fills up Israel's calendar with a whole load of dates. Actually, there are more dates than the ones mentioned in this passage. There's no reference here to the Day of Atonement or to the Feast of Trumpets or to the Year of Jubilee. Those are added elsewhere. But even confining ourselves to what we have in these verses, it's pretty elaborate and full on. The passage stipulates that every seventh day must be a rest from work, verse 12. Then again, the passage stipulates that three times a year, a special feast will necessitate appearing before the Lord God, verse 17, i.e. at a central location, be it the tabernacle or later on the temple. Then again, the passage stipulates that every seventh year, there must be a rest from farming the land. That's verses 10 and 11. And so even though, as I say, the dates in Exodus 23 aren't exhaustive, they don't give us the full picture of Israel's calendar, they themselves are fairly intrusive. They lay a hefty claim on Israel's time. And Israel's calendar is such then that the Israelites are constantly confronted with God. That's the point. And they're belonging to God. And different truths relating to God. Every seventh day confronts them with the truth that God is the true and ultimate rest giver. Every springtime feast of unleavened bread confronts them with the truth that God is the redeemer of his people. Every summertime feast of harvests confronts them with the truth that God is the bountiful provider of their crops. Every autumn time feast of ingathering confronts them with that truth once again. Every seventh year confronts them with the truth that God is the sustainer of the poor and of the animals and of the very soil itself. And there's no escape then, you see, for the Israelites. In their weekly cycle, in their annual cycle, in their seven-yearly cycle, the calendar just keeps prodding them and keeps harassing them and keeps cornering them. Your God, Israel. Your God. Your God. Your God. And isn't it all a bit over the top then? Isn't it just a little bit excessive? Isn't it a bit too much? Well, no more so than when you, as the owner of that property I talked about, are perpetually donning your overalls and getting out your ladders and working away on the roof and on the walls and on the windows and on the guttering and on the arrangements of the sandbags outside the front door. You could decide that that's excessive, that sitting on the patio with a cappuccino gazing at the sea is a far better way of enjoying your dream house than doing all that stuff. But if you take that approach, then the next storm will inflict serious damage. And the one after that, further damage. And so it will go on until you no longer have a dream house that you can comfortably and safely live in. And you see, without these repeated confrontations with the reality of their God, the Israelites will be at the mercy of every storm of pagan temptation that comes their way. And each storm will inflict more damage upon their devotion to Yahweh until eventually it's in ruins and they're out-and-out Baal worshippers. The dates in their calendar are intensive and unrelenting and full-on because they are about maintaining faithfulness. And the simple fact is, faithfulness is demanding. And we New Covenant believers have a calendar. It's a stunningly straightforward one. The first day of the week is the Lord's Day. That's our calendar. And it's relentless. Sunday after Sunday after Sunday after Sunday after Sunday. And it confronts us with God. Just like those dates in Israel's calendar confronted them with God. The Lord's Day, Sunday after Sunday, confronts us with God and with the salvation of God, sealed in the resurrection of Jesus Christ and with the promises of God, focus on an eternal rest in the new creation. And we need those confrontations, just like the Israelites did. At the start of each week, they get us in order so that the storms of pressure and temptation that we shall inevitably face Monday to Saturday won't inflict too much damage on us. I urge you to keep prioritizing the Lord's Day, even when it seems too frequent, too intensive, too inconvenient, when it really gets in the way. Keep prioritizing it. It's crucial maintenance work, I'm saying, on which the health of your faithfulness to God depends. So there's an emphasis here on Israel's calendar. But then secondly, there's an emphasis in verses 10 to 19 on imperceptible compromises. An emphasis on imperceptible compromises. Look at verse 13. Pay attention to all that I have said to you, and make no mention of the names of other gods, nor let it be heard on your lips. Quite strong that, isn't it? Make no mention of the names of other gods. And this prohibition then on mentioning the names of other gods, it isn't superstitious in the way that people in the Harry Potter stories don't mention Voldemort, and those in the theatrical world don't mention Macbeth. It isn't that naming the pagan gods will magically empower these gods to exert some malevolent influence on an Israelite's life. Those gods have no actual existence, so that couldn't possibly be the case. No, the point is that naming them normalizes them. The more that the Israelites mention the gods' names, the less ugly those names become in their ears, and the less abominable those gods become in their perception. If they can name them without a sense of horror, then perhaps they can think about them without a sense of horror. And if they can think about them without a sense of horror, then perhaps they can watch people worshipping them without a sense of horror. And if they can watch people worshipping them without a sense of horror, then perhaps they can be involved themselves in a limited way in the worship of them without a sense of horror. And so it goes on and on. The naming of the gods is an imperceptible compromise. It seems so trivial, but it carries within it disproportionately dangerous potential. Look at verse 18, the first part of that verse. You shall not offer the blood of my sacrifice with anything leavened. You know how Leviticus 17:14 states, the life of every creature is its blood. And that was a widespread conviction then throughout the ancient world. And of course, within Israel, what that meant, according to Yahweh's law, what that meant was that the blood of animals was inedible. It wasn't to be eaten because the life of every creature was in the blood. In pagan cultures, the same conviction took them in the opposite direction. And they ate and drank lots of animal blood, because they saw it then as life-giving. The life was in the blood, and so if they took that somehow magically, it would give them new leases of life. And because then this was going on in the pagan culture surrounding them, it was constantly a temptation to the Israelites. And this prohibition here then relates to this practice of eating or drinking animal blood. But the key point here is the highly subtle form of it that is being prohibited. So we're not talking here about gulping down gallons of the stuff. No, we're talking here about it being baked as an ingredient into bread. You shall not offer the blood of my sacrifice with anything leavened. And that seems to be the meaning, it being just baked as a subtle ingredient into a loaf of bread. You know, like you get these fancy coffees and it will say on the packet that there are undertones of blackberry or cinnamon or chocolate or something, and you can't taste anything like that as you drink the coffee. And that was kind of what the idea here, that they were just putting a bit of blood, virtually unnoticeable, into the bread. But because they had taken on board this idea that it might be beneficial, it might be an empowering thing to do, And so it's just the merest hint, then, of a pagan practice that is being prohibited. I think you have the same kind of thing at the end of verse 19, that you shall not boil a young goat in its mother's milk. You know how then the pagans in their religion were obsessed with fertility. Fertility was the name of the game, really. And the more ways in which their worship pointed to this theme of fertility, the more chance there was, they thought, of getting the Baals to bless their land with fertility. And, of course, in its least subtle form, this involved acts of prostitution at the temple in order to get the gods to pour down fertility on the land. But there were more subtle ways as well in which pagan worship pointed to this theme of fertility. And it seems that one way then was this: when a goat was being sacrificed to a god at the temple, they would boil it in its mother's milk. Maternal milk in the ancient world was this great symbol of fertility. And so it was just another way. Boiling the goat in its mother's milk was just another way of introducing this theme of fertility into the worship, with the idea of extracting fertility from the god upon the land. And again then, if the Israelites were to do this, it would be a very subtle, low-key encroachment of paganism. It's not like temple prostitution or anything. Just very subtle, very low-key, just boiling a goat in its mother's milk. But again, it's prohibited. And these subtle encroachments of paganism then are being prohibited because they open the door. They open the door to more. It's likely that they will lead to further encroachments. They are these imperceptible compromises. They seem so trivial in themselves, but they set a course, they set a trajectory. And so Yahweh is insistent and adamant in prohibiting them. Look at the end of verse 18, the second half of that verse. Don't let the fat of my feast remain until the morning. That seems to be a reference to one of the feasts in particular, the Feast of Unleavened Bread. The Feast of Unleavened Bread, of course, is really Passover. The same feast can be called by either name, depending on which emphasis is in view. And remember how at the Passover meal, we saw earlier in Exodus, the whole animal was to be eaten in the meal at the night. None of it was to be left over until the morning. And of all the details then, for Yahweh to single out here all the details of the Passover meal and of the whole Passover celebration, of all the details, for it to be this one, it just seems so minor, doesn't it? I mean, surely if an Israelite is slaughtering an animal and is putting the blood of the animal on the door frames of his house, surely whether or not he leaves a bit of meat over until the next morning, that's neither here nor there. He's doing the main things. This is just a minor detail by comparison. But again, you see, Yahweh is insistent. If a divine stipulation about leaving meat until the next morning is negotiable, then what other divine stipulations might be negotiable? Again, it opens a door. And then I think there's one further example in verse 19. The best of the first fruits of your ground you shall bring into the house of the Lord your God. And the emphasis there then is on the best of. And again, it seems pedantic. Here we have an Israelite who is offering their first fruits. And it's just the quality that's the issue. Surely that's not a big deal. Well, yes, it is, Yahweh insists. The point being that if the best of your crops are ring-fenced, if they are inaccessible to Yahweh, if they're out of bounds for God, then what else in your life might start to fall into that same category of being out of bounds to God? And so repeatedly here, then, in these verses, this point is being made. Imperceptible compromises need to be nipped in the bud. That's the point. And the New Testament is full of that kind of teaching, isn't it? Ephesians 5 verse 3, sexual immorality and all impurity must not even be named among you. A little bit similar, actually, isn't it, to verse 13 here, about the gods not being named. Ephesians 5 verse 12. It is shameful even to speak of the things that they do in secret. Talking about the pagans, the Gentiles. Again, even to speak of them. Ephesians 4 27. Give no opportunity to the devil. Not even just a little sliver where he can get his foot in. Romans 13, 14. Put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh. Don't give it any foothold. Hebrews 2, verse 1. We must pay much closer attention to what we've heard, lest we drift away from it. That idea just gradually, slowly drifting. Hebrews 3:13, but encourage one another daily as long as it is called today, so that none of you may be hardened by sin's deceitfulness. Just gradually, insidiously hardening you in a way that you barely even notice is happening. Matthew 16, verses 11 and 12, Jesus says, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees. And then Matthew says, then they understood that he did not tell them to beware the leaven of bread, but of the teaching of the Pharisees and Sadducees. And so Jesus is depicting this false teaching, this hypocritical teaching of the Pharisees and Sadducees as being like yeast that just slowly, slowly takes effect in someone until they've been brainwashed by it. And the point of all this teaching then is that we don't usually fall into some gross sin, or we don't usually walk away from God in a sudden, out of the blue way. That doesn't usually happen. It happens by stages. A whole series of tiny, imperceptible compromises, each of which by itself seems so innocuous. And yet each of which is taking us further and further down a certain course. Are you watching things on television that you wouldn't have done once over in your Christian life? Do you feel less concerned these days about frittering away time at work than you would have done once when you were far more conscientious? Do you allow busyness and tiredness to squeeze out prayer at this stage in your life in a way that you wouldn't have done 10 or 20 years ago? And so we could go on. We need to ask ourselves sometimes those questions. And we need to be hard on those imperceptible compromises when we detect them in our lives. It can seem excessive being hard on them. It's just a little matter we can say to ourselves. But again, it's like doing that work on your beachside house when you could be sunbathing on the patio. It's necessary maintenance. Failing to do so could be disastrous, and failing to stamp out these imperceptible compromises could be disastrous for your Christian life. Keep up that work. Keep a close eye on yourself. Keep track of the little shifts, which can easily just be overlooked, but actually are quite significant. The little shifts in your life that are taking you in a certain direction, don't tire of detecting them and stamping them out and clamping down on them. Faithfulness is demanding. Well, that's verses 10 to 19. And then secondly, and more briefly, faithfulness is delightful. Faithfulness is delightful. This is verses 20 to 33. And just let me show you how this section of the passage works. I think it has two halves, which are more or less symmetrical. So there's verses 20 to 26, and then there's verses 27 to 33. And that is marked then in the passage by the way in which both halves begin with God talking about sending something before Israel. So verse 20, behold, I send an angel before you. And then verse 27, I will send my terror before you. And those two verses then introduce these two halves, which are both, as I say, basically saying the same kind of stuff. They're symmetrical. And Both halves then of this section, they include the theme of faithfulness to God. So verses 24 and 25, you shall not bow down to their gods, nor serve them, nor do as they do, but you shall utterly overthrow them and break their pillars in pieces. You shall serve the Lord your God. So there you have faithfulness to God. And in the second half, you have it in verses 32 and 33, you shall make no covenant with them and their gods. They shall not dwell in your land, lest they make you sin against me. If you serve their gods, it will surely be a snare to you. But it seems to me then that in both halves, this faithfulness to God is now presented as delightful. And you might say, well, doesn't that contradict what we've been saying? We've been saying that it's demanding, it's hard work. How then can faithfulness to God also be delightful? Well, two ways. First of all, it flows from what God has done. Faithfulness to God, it flows from what God has done. So it's in the land of Canaan then that the Israelites are to exercise this faithfulness. That's what all of this is looking forward to. It's when they're in the land. That's where they are to live in this faithful way. But how are they going to be there in the first place? Well, God is going to see to that. He's going to see to that through the sending of this one who is both an angel to bring you to the place that I have prepared, verse 20, and a terror to make all your enemies turn their backs to you, verse 27. So you see, through this dual action, God is first going to be faithful to them, to the Israelites. The Israelites are going to experience his faithfulness in the first place, and their faithfulness to God simply flows from that as the appropriate response. It's the principle that's classically expressed a little later in the Pentateuch in Deuteronomy chapter 6. You know these verses, Deuteronomy 6, verses 4 and 5. I think they are sometimes misunderstood, but Deuteronomy 6, verse 4, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one." And I don't think that's making a philosophical point about God being this undivided being, but it's saying the Lord our God is one in his commitment to his people. He's wholehearted. He's not divided. He's not being pulled in lots of different directions, but he's wholehearted. He's single in his commitment to his people. And then verse 5 goes on, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might." In other words, because God is one toward you, you are to be one toward him. But you see the order. God's faithfulness in the first place, and then the response flowing from that is his people's faithfulness. And our faithfulness to God then, as new covenant believers, it works in just the same way, doesn't it? God doesn't require it from us as this random, out of the blue thing. No, he first shows stunning faithfulness toward us. He does so actually by sending someone, a little bit like the terms we have in this passage, by sending his son. Indeed, it's not difficult, is it, to see his son being prefigured in the one who is sent here in Exodus 23. This one we read in verse 21, "My name is in him." Well, the one in whom supremely the name of God existed was Jesus Christ. And he was sent then by God to bring us to the place that he has prepared, bringing many sons to glory, Hebrews 2 verse 10. And he was sent to be a terror to our enemies, to destroy the works of the devil, we have in 1 John 3:8, to destroy by death him who holds the power of death. And so God has first shown stunning faithfulness to us in sending his own son, Jesus Christ, in this dual action to bring us home to glory, to drive our enemies into the dust. And our faithfulness to God is simply the appropriate response which flows from that. I wonder if you've forgotten that. And has faithfulness to God become to you just this kind of abstract duty, which you do and you get on with, but you do so with little relish because you've divorced it from this all-important backdrop that God has first been stunningly faithful to us? Perhaps you've dropped five words out of Romans chapter 12, verse 1. I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice. Perhaps you've turned that into, I appeal to you, brothers, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice. That's all you see, your duty, your responsibility to serve God tomorrow and the next day and the next day. And you've forgotten those five words, by the mercies of God. What mercies? The mercies that chapters 1 to 11 of Romans have laid out so eloquently. This God who in astonishing grace has rescued us through his Son, Jesus Christ. That is the basis on which we are faithful to God, because he, in a far, far greater way, has been faithful toward us. And faithfulness is delightful then. First of all, because it flows from what God has done. But then secondly, it looks for what God will do. It looks for what God will do. And in both halves then of this section that we're looking at now, verses 20 to 33, interestingly, the promise is there that faithfulness by the Israelites will result in further blessing. Faithfulness will result in further blessing. So verses 25 and 26, you shall serve the Lord your God, and he will bless your bread and your water, and I will take sickness away from among you. None shall miscarry or be barren in your land. I will fulfill the number of your days. In the second half, it's a little more subtle, but I think it's there in verses 29 and 30, this kind of gradual way in which God is going, once they're in the land, is going to drive out their enemies so that the land is manageable. If they were just given an empty land all at once, it wouldn't be manageable. But he's going to gradually drive out the current inhabitants, and gradually then they will increase and possess the land, the end of verse 30 there. So the Israelites were to be faithful to God, looking for God's blessing that comes to those who are faithful. And so I think we are to be as well. Not in the sense that if we are faithful to God, then health and fertility and long life, as mentioned there in verses 25 and 26, will come to us. God's people here in the Old Covenant era are in their infancy, as Paul will put it in the letter to Galatians. They're in the phase of their infancy when God dealt with them through graphic pictures and props in the way that we teach our infants. And now the people of God has passed out of that old covenant infancy stage, and we no longer need the props, the health and the fertility and the long life. But the principle underlying those props that was being taught through them, that blessing comes from God to those who are faithful to him, that principle still applies. And we see it then in various places in the New Testament. James 4, verse 8, draw near to God, which isn't really in the context talking about in a worship service. Sometimes these words are used perhaps at the start of a worship service, but it's talking about in your life, in a repentant kind of lifestyle, draw near to God. And what's the promise? He will draw near to you. You will know the closeness and intimacy of God as you draw near to him by your repentant lifestyle day by day. 1 Peter 3, we have a couple of examples of this being taught in 1 Peter 3. We have it being taught in a very specific context to husbands in 1 Peter 3, 7. Husbands, live with your wives in an understanding way, showing honor to the woman as the weaker vessel, since they are heirs with you of the grace of life. And then he has this, so that your prayers may not be hindered. So if you are being lousy husbands, Peter writes to his male readers, then don't expect your prayers to be answered. God will be distant. He won't cease to be your God, but he will be distant. And the converse of that is that as you are being righteous in your homes, living properly, then the blessing of God's attentiveness will be yours. And that is then expanded in the following verses, where he interestingly writes, finally, all of you have unity of mind, sympathy, brotherly love, a tender heart, a humble mind. Do not repay evil for evil or reviling for revival, but on the contrary, bless, for to this you were called, that you may obtain a blessing. And it's clear he's not there talking about a blessing in the world to come, because he continues then by quoting from Psalm 34, whoever desires to love life and see good days, let him keep his tongue from evil and his lips from speaking deceit. Let him turn away from evil and do good. Let him seek peace and pursue it. For the eyes of the Lord are on the righteous and his ears are open to their prayer. And again, then, the blessing that comes to those who are living in this faithful way is God's attentiveness. His eyes are open to them and his ears attentive to their prayers. The closeness, the intimacy of their God. Matthew 5:8, blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God supremely in the world to come. But I'm sure Jesus also intends there that you will have clearer visions of God now, the purer that your hearts are, the less clouded your heart vision is by impurity. Or perhaps most of all, Psalm 37 verse 4, delight yourselves in the Lord and he will give you the desires of your hearts, which is easily abused by those who want to preach health and wealth, but which I think means that actually the truest desires of your heart, whether you know it or not, are for God. And therefore, as you delight yourself in the Lord, you will in fact be fulfilling the deepest desires of your heart as he gives himself to you and you know more of him and you have a deeper experience of him. And so to put all this perhaps the other way around, a Christian living a half-hearted, lukewarm, pedestrian kind of lifestyle, that's not a happy road. That's not a road full of God's blessing. It may be a road that will end up at the celestial city, but it's not a happy and a blessing-filled road. Where is the blessedness I knew when first I saw the Lord? Where is the soul-refreshing view of Jesus and his word? Those are the words, aren't they, of someone who is mired in sin. And they're still in the grip of God's hand, but the soul-refreshing views of Jesus and his word have gone. The joy of his salvation. David lost the joy of God's salvation in his sin. He didn't lose his salvation, but he lost the joy of God's salvation. There is blessing that is forfeited when we're living the Christian life poorly. And there's blessing to be gained when we are living the Christian life faithfully and God-honoringly. And so I urge you this morning to pursue with all your heart faithfulness to God, to be devoted to him, to be committed to him. It doesn't mean you'll get health and wealth, but it may well lead to experiences of God and experiences of the joy of God's salvation that are sublime and beautiful, and which perhaps you're not experiencing at this moment. May God bless his word to us. Amen.